Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, including the host, Carol Marx, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick off this hour with Carol Marx in conversation with Patricia Morris-Rowe. She's a journalist and author of the critically acclaimed Mapplethorpe biography. She's going to talk now to Carol about her memoir, Nine and a Half Narrow, My Life in Shoes, published by Gotham Books.
I was surprised to learn, though, that high-heeled shoes were invented in the 16th century, and really amazed by the way what type of shoes, you know, played in different people's lives back then, including Marie Antoinette wearing them to her beheading. Oh,
well,
my.
Yes, Marie Antoinette was a total shoe fanatic, as we also saw in that Sofia Coppola movie about Marie Antoinette, where Manolo Blahnik, I believe, they used a lot of Manolo Blahnik shoes. But, you know, she was very careful about even the kinds of shoes she wore to her beheading, and she wore black plum mules to her beheading. And when I read that, that really stood out in my mind, because I'm not exactly sure if I were heading to my beheading, I would probably just wear a pair of flip-flops or something. But shoes were very, very important to her. As they have been really from the very, very beginning. I mean, when you think of Venetian women in the 17th century, they wore these massive, what they called chopines, that could be anywhere from 5 inches to 20 inches off the ground. And, you know, women in Venetian society did not have that many options. They could be a nun or a courtesan, you know, or a wife. And wives basically stayed at home. And when they did go out in their chopines, they needed servants to kind of hoist them around.
I bet. And you've also written the shoes are thought to indicate the character of the person that's wearing them. For example, and I found this fascinating, what did people say about the bright red shoes that were also high-heeled? There were Double Dare Pumps by Naughty Monkey that Sarah Palin wore in her debut as a vice presidential candidate.
I thought that was really fascinating, the way women... the way women's shoes in politics were so scrutinized. I mean, she wore a very cheap pair of kind of racy pumps, which really, you know, definitely dressed in very different clothes and shoes later on, but I mean, I think that was the essence of who she was in many respects. And then you had poor Michelle Bachmann, who was criticized for wearing hose with sandals. And then Condoleezza Rice, who has admitted that she's crazy about shoes, was roundly criticized when she showed up at the Ferragamo store in New York during Hurricane Katrina. That was her, you know, let them eat cake moment. But, you know, people really don't notice what men wear on their feet. But women's shoes, particularly women in the public eye, you know, are very highly criticized.
I say, don't look at the shoe. You know, don't look at... Anyway, that's, you know...
Or don't look at hair, but that's the way, unfortunately, women have been,
Yes, that's the way we're characterized and criticized for. Now, how did your passion for shoes, Patricia, really get started, and what did your mother have to do with the beginning of your shoe, really, you know, interest, and what caused you to wear very impractical, I would say, white Mary Janes at the age of 7, because you know what white shoes do? They get so dirty.
They do get dirty, and I had a picture in an album of me actually looking like Cinderella, sweeping the street in these white shoes. I like them, and you know, when you're a baby, what color are the shoes? They're white little booties. But when I was younger and at church, we had the daughter of a movie star who lived in town. She was the movie star, very few people remember her, but she was Priscilla Lane, who was a star in the 30s and 40s, and Hannah was her daughter, and I was completely gaga over Hannah. And then when I saw Hannah in these white patent leather Mary Janes, that was it for me. I wanted those shoes. I needed those shoes because I wanted, I think, to be the daughter of a movie star. I mean, it was what the shoes represented more than the shoes themselves.
And you know, you also grew up at the height of Beatlemania, and not only were you in love with Paul McCartney,
yes,
but so was your mother. So how much was she into the Beatles and Paul, and did you think that that was the ultimate embarrassment?
So embarrassing. I mean, and my mother loved classical music too, but my mother, even up until the end of her life, was very up on pop culture. So, you know, I'd come home and be talking about Paul, and then my mother would love Paul, and then we would get into these arguments. Well, I bet you don't know how old Paul was when his mother died. Well, she, you know, he was this age and that age. But I never had to beg for Beatle albums. I always got the Beatle magazines immediately, along with like 16 in Tiger Beat. And my mother and I would listen to Beatle albums together until, you know, we inevitably got into fights, as mother and daughters do. And, you know, that was that. But then I was in this ridiculous band called the Beatle Girls, and then I needed Beatle boots. It's funny, but perhaps one of the more embarrassing episodes of my life, where my three friends and I lip-synced for the Brownies. We were very popular with the Brownies, lip-syncing Beatles songs. And then, I needed the Beatle boots, but they only made them for men. So my mother was mortified. She was mortified. I mean, it was like, and I was Ringo, who was her least favorite Beatle. I mean, she couldn't understand why I couldn't be Paul. So now I was Ringo, who she referred to as the ugly one. And then when I announced that I was Ringo in the band, it was almost as if I'd announced I'd had a sex change operation. And then bought men's Beatle boots. So
there
it was
you go.
Funny,
you,
but she was appalled.
And fast-forwarding to your life, in the 70s, you moved to New York to pursue your passion for journalism, and you bought your first pair of Oxfords because you saw Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, and you were really, you know, loved them. And then you found a man who loved both Oxfords and you, Woody Allen. So, and he was a great mentor to you. So what did he do?
Well, this was Woody. That was my Woody look-alike, not the real Woody Allen. I fell in love with a man who looked exactly like Woody Allen. And at the time, I kind of looked a little bit like Diane Keaton, certainly tried to dress like her. So we would walk down the street, it was almost like the Beatles, and people would think, there goes Diane and Woody. But I loved Oxfords, and I loved the whole concept of menswear. And they were comfortable. That was the thing. I mean, Oxfords at the time were very fashionable, and they were comfortable.
So did you ever really meet Woody Allen?
His sister lives in my building, so I've seen him in the elevator, but that's as close, sadly, as I've come to him.
Now, you said that shoes are fun to shop for because they don't require you to enter a dressing room, and then you've got to stare at your body under unflattering lights. But I do find it very trying, Tricia, today, that while I can get the latest, most fashionable shoes at, you know, relatively inexpensive prices if I go to really good discount stores, but there's no one to measure your feet, no one to find what you're looking for, no help in trying them on, and I long for those aluminum contraptions.
Right, the Brannock device, where when we were little, you know, every time you'd go to a shoe store, they'd pull out the device, and you knew exactly what size you were. But those are also were the days when they had, you know, AAA or Triple E. Now, because of the decline in the shoe industry, I mean, there is really no shoe industry in the United States anymore, and because of that, we're getting a lot of the European brands, and the Europeans have traditionally just made shoes in the medium width. So if you're, for example, wanting to buy designer shoes, all you get is medium. I mean, which to me is absolutely absurd. It's like if we told men, sorry, you can only get shirts in size 15. I mean, so that's why a lot of the shoes don't fit. And I have a narrow foot, and it's very difficult for me to get shoes.
I also find that with, say, the medium width, that it varies according to the shoes. So you have to try them on, and some mediums will fit better than others.
Absolutely.
But so this is another thing.
Get so seduced by the idea of shoes, they don't even, the concept of fit doesn't enter into their mind as much as it would if they were, you know, trying on a dress or a suit or something. I mean, a lot of women just grab ill-fitting shoes, which is why when they get older, you know, their feet are sprouting bunions and corns and look deformed, but then, you know, they can have Cinderella surgery and fix it all.
That's Patricia Morris-Rowe in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled 9½ Narrow, My Life in Shoes, published by Gotham Books. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. It is important to address a personal emergency response system in your home in case of falls or injuries. AARP encourages their use for many older Americans to enhance independence and security, especially for those living alone. Many brands of PERS are available on the market, and seniors should consider their specific needs and budget before deciding on a system. The Federal Trade Commission provides free online information. One can get a system as basic as wearing a necklace or bracelet and push a button that will transmit to an installed response center through your landline telephone. In the event of an emergency with falls, chest pain, a suspected intruder, a press of the button will have a 911 ambulance dispatched to your home, even if you cannot reach your phone. PERS systems can be rented or purchased through local hospitals and are affordable and serviced by representatives. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of our program, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Dr. Richard Jacoby. He's a leading peripheral nerve surgeon and author of the book Sugar Crush, How to Reduce Inflammation, Reverse Nerve Damage, and Reclaim Good Health, published by Harper Wave.
Now, today, Americans eat an amazing 160 pounds of processed sugar. This wasn't always true, because until the 1800s, refined sugar or sucrose was expensive. What happened then to make table sugar less expensive, you know, and is probably responsible for our eating more of it?
Well, it certainly is. When you really go back to Columbus and his second voyage, he brought sugar to the Americas, and that's how we built our country. Sugar was taken back to England, and it was about $1,000 a pound in the 1600s. So only the rich ate sugar, and only the rich had the diseases of modern day today. And that's what's the amazing point. When you look through the medical literature, you think these diseases have been around for a long time, but they only been around when sugar was introduced.
And then what new and even more destructive form of sugar came on the market?
Yeah, the high fructose corn syrup, in my opinion, is the major detriment to our health care system. High fructose corn syrup, interestingly enough, is actually made with lye, which is sodium hydroxide. And sodium hydroxide is made with mercury. Now, they're trying not to make it with mercury anymore, but there's several reports of mercury seeping into our food supply. 80% of the food in the United States has high fructose corn syrup, and a third of that had mercury in the food supply.
But I learned so many interesting things from your book, and I had never realized how much hidden sugar is in our diet. And there are some processed foods, in fact, you named two of them, that I would never have thought had added sugar.
Yeah, the processed foods, I tell my patients, I say, if it, they ask me, what should I eat? And I said, if it tastes good, don't eat it, unless you look at the label, because I guarantee you it has sugar in it. That's why it tastes so good. High fructose corn syrup is extremely addicting and tastes exceedingly well. It's much sweeter than regular sugar. So if you're eating something and you really like it, I guarantee you it has sugar in it. My book, however, it gets really into more of the biochemistry of the action of sugar on the nerve. And that's really the key point. sugar is causing a biochemical reaction which causes compression of the nerve, not only in the nerves in the lower extremity, but the nerves throughout the body. And when I went through the literature from the 1400s, it became abundantly clear to me that all these diseases are the same. Alzheimer's, autism, peripheral neuropathy, carpal tunnel, even Bell's palsy, things that you would never think are related to sugar, are, in fact, a nerve compression. There's been a lot of talk about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. There was a lot of fanfare last year with people pouring ice water on their heads, if you recall that. At least it brought attention to the fact that this is a very, very serious disease and it's increasing in prevalence. And the answer, in my opinion, is sugar.
Now, what I found also very interesting was what you had to say in your book about the effect of excess sugar and how it affects cancer, because, again, that was very enlightening.
It was to me as well. When I did the research for the book, I came upon Otto Warburg, who got the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1931. He mapped out the fact that sugar, and specifically fructose, was a cause of cancer. And what he meant by that is cancer cells thrive on sugar. Their rate of turnover in the mitochondria, that's the portion in the cell that produces energy, they depend on fructose. If you go on a ketogenic diet, which means no carbohydrates, no sugar whatsoever, you'll produce ketones. Ketones kill cancer cells. Yet today, I ask many different doctors if they have ever heard of Otto Warburg, and no one seems to have heard of him. And I say, well, he got the Nobel Prize, not the Marvel comic book prize, but the Nobel Prize in medicine. We have gotten away from our natural diet. This sugar epidemic is killing us.
And also, as you say, you mentioned that the effect that the sugar has on the nerves. And is this effect very specifically causing, you know, chronic inflammation, which I understand is also behind a lot of our diseases?
It is. The whole concept of fat for the last 50 years, which we have been, in my opinion, been educated into ignorance. Fat was never the problem. It was always sugar. But around after World War II, in the early 50s, we were told that fat was bad, and we got morphed over to vegetable oils such as mazola, basically oil from corn. And margarine became very popular because butter was expensive. Really what we should eat, and we have always eaten, is good fats, omega-3 fatty acids. Anything from a grass-fed animal that produces butter, milk, meat, anything that's natural is good. Those that are produced by wheat or grains are bad. That produces omega-6 fatty acids, which is very inflammatory.
But doctor, it's so hard to get grass-fed beef and things like that. So what do we do?
Well, it is hard to get it, but it is only because it's more expensive, because it takes much longer to raise farm animals with grass. It's much cheaper for the farmer to raise them with grains such as corn. But in the long run, it's cheaper because our toll in our medical care is magnitudes greater than what it cost us to produce the food in the first place.
And I got to ask you, because, you know, with our addiction to sweets, and I've got to tell you that I've been guilty of this, I have swapped sugar for artificial sweeteners, and particularly the artificial herb stevia. So why has that been a bad idea?
Well, all the artificial sweeteners are a bad idea, aspartame, etc. Stevia, however, is an exception. Stevia does not cause an insulin response, and that's really what I talk about in the book. However, I'm not in favor of anything sweet, because then it's hard to get off that desire for sweet things. So I put, as I say in my book, I put butter in my coffee. That, to me, cuts that desire for sweets completely away. You're not hungry anymore. You don't feel the need to find something sweet. And eating food then becomes a joy because you're satiated, not full, but satiated. You're satisfied.
And in your book, you talk about two kinds of diets that people can have. And one is the ketogenic diet, if I pronounce it right. And the other is a blood regulation diet. So what's the difference between the two diets, and is one a little easier to follow?
Yes. Well, I think if you're addicted to sugar, which everybody is who is overweight, if you're overweight, you're addicted to sugar, because the only way you can gain weight is to produce insulin. Insulin binds the fat molecule, and it stores it on your body. If you eat food that has no insulin response, then you'll lose weight. So you can go cold turkey, in other words, ketogenic diet, no carbs, you will lose weight rapidly. Most people can't do that. It's too severe. So I suggest you just do a step-down type of process where you gradually eliminate carbohydrates from your diet and regulate your sugars very slowly over a period of time. But if you want to lose weight, use butter in coffee, and you will lose a pound a day. And the biggest problem with that, going to a ketogenic diet, you'll just keep losing weight until you add some carbs back in.
Now, what do you hope that our listeners and your readers take away from this book?
Number one, that all these itises, as I call them, from Alzheimer's to autism to peripheral neuropathy or carpal tunnel, they're all the same disease, the same mechanism. Sugar is causing the inflammation, and the body heals by fibrosis or scarring, and it's scarring down your nerves and shutting off the blood supply to the end organ. So giving up sugar is essential. Transferring over to a fat-based diet is essential.
That's Dr. Richard Jacoby in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Sugar Crush, How to Reduce Inflammation, Reverse Nerve Damage, and Reclaim Good Health, published by Harbor Wave. For more information, go to sugarrushthebook.com. Coming up, Steve Wiseman will be joining us, as well as Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. All that's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues. Michael Harrison here with you on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Very proud to be with you on this program. This program has been on the air in one form or another consistently now for over two decades. Kind of runs below the radar. It's heard on weekends on great talk radio stations around the country. And what I'm really proud about in terms of this program, in which I have the opportunity to serve as anchor, not as host. Carol Marx is the host, and I certainly am not the only voice on this show. We have a round table of outstanding personalities, experts, and broadcasters. What I love about this show is that in an industry marked by concern, focus, obsession with youth, and believe me, I'm about as young thinking as anybody you'll meet. Sometimes I'm even accused of being immature. And so I'm all for that, and I'm all for looking ahead. But I'm also for fairness, and I'm also for respect. And the media in America, driven by, obviously, Madison Avenue and commercial concerns, focuses primarily on young people. And if somebody's over 50 or 55 or 60, they quite often find that there's a lot lacking in terms of what's available in the mainstream media. So this program, which was conceived and developed by Carol Marx more than 20 years ago, originally was called Senior Focus, and it evolved into A Touch of Gray, and I became involved with it along the way, is something that really provides a service in as much as it unashamedly, unabashedly, unapologetically brings information to people via this wonderful medium of radio that is of use, of interest, of service, of comfort, of support to people over 50 years of age and their families, which is why I say at the beginning of the program, children of all ages, because so many people in their 50s find themselves in a situation that has been kind of accurately and colorfully termed the sandwich generation, meaning they have children, adult children, still living with them, and abiding by the rule that came down a long time ago, honor thy father and thy mother, they have their parents living with them. In many cases, these parents are in their 80s, 90s, and are living at home. And the amount of pressure that can be put on somebody dealing with adult children and senior parents all under one roof is extraordinary, and it's a phenomenon that in many ways I applaud. I'm all for family staying together. But also, there are people who are in need of support and information. So in many ways, A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, is in fact a program for children of all ages. But I salute Carol Marx. I think that she has done and continues to do a remarkable job. And she does it under sometimes the worst of conditions because, like the rest of us, she's not getting any younger either. But she drives herself to research and get the information needed and select guests and topics. And not only that, she travels around the world and brings information from other countries on how their healthcare systems operate and how the services that they provide for senior citizens there are taken care of and done. And she brings that information back, not to mention she acts as a model, as a role model for people to get up and get out and live life and do things. And she's done everything from, she's explored, you know, if there were four corners on this planet, as the saying goes, she's been to all four of them. Check her out at the website, atouchofgrey.com. Gray is spelled with an E. And I just wanted to mention that she is one fine lady, and we're grateful to be involved with her in this project.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgrey.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgrey.com. We spell gray with an E. A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined at this point in the program by Kevin Casey, who is the vice president and executive editor of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication in the talk radio business, as well as being a special correspondent, a senior correspondent on our program. Kevin, politics, of course, will be a mainstay of talk radio conversation between now and 2016. Of course, after a month of the election, they'll start talking about 2020. So it's becoming a cliche to say it's starting early because it never stops.
No, it doesn't anymore, does it?
It's sort of like the football season, you know?
Yeah.
There's always something going on and somebody jockeying for something. But I don't know. It seems to me, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, that there are more people running, at least on the Republican ticket this year, than we usually see running on either party.
Yeah, in my memory and in recent, I cannot remember when there were, 15 candidates now. Mm-hmm. For the Republican nomination. And an interesting thing happened is we learned recently that both CNN and Fox News, who are going to have debates in the primaries, they're going to limit the Republican candidates to 10 slots. Apparently they only have 10 podiums in the back storage room at the
facilities. Well, it kind of looks funny.
even to see 10 people on the stage having some kind of a debate, it's more of a like a beauty pageant than it is a debate.
And it's hard to get in depth on a show with 15 people. But what they're going to have to do is limit. And both networks have said that they are going to limit it to 10 slots. Hmm. And that means five Republicans are going to be shut out of those debates based upon polls.
What it basically comes down to is there are certain types of candidates, and then you have more than one in each. Usually there's one leader in each of the positions, like the far right one, the one that's moderate, the one that's interested in economic issues, the one that's interested in foreign policy. In this case, you got two, three, of four in each of those categories that are basically indistinguishable from the others. They should draw lots and then have one of each of the categories go into the debate. It would be a lot more efficient, don't you think?
I do, and I think that ultimately that's what's going to happen without anyone needing to force it, because the polling itself will reflect that. Mm-hmm. If you have similar candidates and they're just not as popular as the other similar candidate, then that person's going to fall by the wayside.
Mm. I wonder, and we only have about 30 seconds left, whether or not it hurts the Republicans to have this much conversation going on prior to the general election, or it hurts the Democrats not having that much.
Great question, and the answer to which I do not know.
Yeah, I don't think there is an answer, because it also depends on the candidates that are running when the November election is at hand. Thank you, Kevin. Very interesting. Kevin Casey is the executive editor. He's the vice president, executive editor of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication in talk radio. If you want to know more about what's going on in this medium, it's talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and A Touch of Gray continues in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. The National Institute of Mental Health reports elderly depression to be a serious public health problem. Recent research shows 15% of persons over 60, or roughly 6.5 million Americans, are suffering from depression, while 25% state they suffer from sadness. Health practitioners that care and treat the elderly, including primary care physicians, are unprepared to detect and diagnose depression. Let's review depression's warning signs. Are you experiencing feelings of helplessness or sadness, most of the time lasting 2 weeks or longer? Have family members, friends noticed social withdrawal, self-neglect with personal hygiene, appearance, clothing, loss of appetite, weight loss, and maybe dehydration? Has your physical pain increased? Has there been a major loss, illness, or surgery recently? If any of these scenarios exist, an evaluation by a qualified MD is recommended. Successful treatment of depression would include both psychotherapy and medications. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We're joined the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. In conversation now with Emily Nagoski, Ph.D. She's a wellness education director, lecturer, and campus favorite at Smith College, where she teaches women's sexuality. She's the author of a book titled, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life, published by Simon & Schuster.
Emily, I gotta tell you, when I read the book, one of the things, and there's a lot of information in there, and I'm a guy, this is a book about women's sexuality, but it certainly helps a man to know about this. But the thing that brought a smile to my face with so much information was you have, at the end of each chapter, the TLDR section, too long, didn't read, where you have bullet points of the information. How did you decide to do that?
That was in the very last draft I finally decided to do that, because my husband has a pretty short attention span.
We all do.
Many people do.
No, I meant
and
men.
It was based on his attention span that I was like, let me just wrap it up in 4 bullet points so that if a person is reading the book and they want to explain it to someone else, they can just read them this.
And it was terrific. The other thing, so that was at the end of your chapter, is the very opening of the book opens with the words, yes, you are normal. Now, why'd you start the book like that?
Because it turns out that's the most important thing that my students have learned. When I was teaching the class, I asked my students just to write down one really important thing they learned. And this is a class where I have shoehorned in all the science that I can sit into the class. And what they answered was not the evolutionary biology or the anatomy or the brain science, but just that I'm normal. I learned I'm normal. I learned that being different from other people doesn't make me broken or abnormal.
That's great. You know, you talk about evolutionary biology. Has sex changed in, you know, over time?
The rules that we've made about sex have changed, but our biology itself and the way our bodies work hasn't changed. However, because our bodies are sensitive to context, so our evolutionary ancestors didn't necessarily feel a sense of body self-consciousness that we feel. That's a learned response. But the way our body responds has not changed.
How much misinformation do really intelligent people today still have about sex?
Almost all of the information most people have about sex is wrong. One of the things that I have noticed, the more education I got about sex, the more of a gulf I noticed between what science understanding of sex is and how the mainstream discourse happens around sex. So my job sort of was to bridge that gap, to bring people up to date with how desire actually does work, how arousal and orgasm actually do work, because sort of everything is wrong.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about female sexuality?
I think that the desire piece really is the biggest one. The standard story is that desire just sort of appears out of the blue. You're walking down the street and you feel this internal urge. I would like to get me some sex. How can I get that? And so after that, you go into the arousal phase and through the rest of the cycle. And that absolutely is a way that some people do experience desire, at least some of the time, for sure. And there's another way of experiencing desire called responsive desire, where you're just sitting there reading a book and your partner starts touching your arm or kissing your neck and your body goes, oh, right, sex, that's a really good idea. So spontaneous desire emerges in anticipation of arousal, whereas responsive desire is in response to arousal, and that is just as normal and healthy a way of experiencing desire as spontaneous. It doesn't have to just appear out of the blue in order to be normal.
You know, you talk about the range of normal, and it does seem that one of the biggest problems is people communicating with their partners in regards to sex. And is that still a problem, and do people still have trouble communicating what they want and how they feel?
Yeah, you know, I did a training session with a group of sex therapists, and the story that they told me about a lot of their clients is that people will be in a relationship for 10 or 15 years, and that whole time they will be not telling their partner what they actually want or like, or when you approach me in that way, I find it really uncomfortable,
yeah.
Or when you touch me in that way, I don't really like it, because they don't want to hurt their partner's feelings. It is lovingly intended, but it leaves people with this tangled knot of communication, and they begin to have to undo all those. So our desire to be kind and gentle with our partner is actually interfering with our ability to be honest with them. So telling a person you don't necessarily like something doesn't have to hurt their feelings. And I talk about communication strategies for making your partner feel like a superhero when you explain to them what it is you actually want in bed.
How does sex change as we age, and when does it happen? Range, of course.
Yeah, there's a range, and it can change in a whole lot of ways. For some people, sex diminishes because they feel like there's less of an expectation and they're not as connected with their bodies. But for a lot of people, sex actually increases and gets better because all these cultural messages that we get about what our bodies are supposed to look like and what we're supposed to do and say and be, we sort of let that all go and recognize that it's nonsense, and we can be and do anything we want with our bodies, and we feel really comfortable finally living inside our bodies, and so sex can really expand. So it changes the entire range is the way sex changes over the lifespan.
What can we do to make it better?
I think there's really, well, one is to make it not about orgasm. Sex is about pleasure, and if that's your goal, if you're experiencing pleasure, you know you are doing it right. When you let go of the goal, it releases you from the expectation and the pressure and the performance, and also pay a lot of attention to your partner. There is no more important stimulus in our lives than our partner. So recognize the ways that they experience pleasure, because their pleasure will amplify your pleasure, like light bouncing off a mirror. And then finally, I would say, whatever you're doing, enjoy the sex you are having, as opposed to imagining the sort of phantom sex we were taught that we were supposed to be having. Let go of that imaginary, made-up, fictional sexuality and enjoy the sexuality that you have.
And, you know, as much as sex is great, it really is physically, isn't it good for us?
Absolutely. It's a form of physical activity. It is a form of affectionate bonding with people we care about and trust, which actually reduces all of our stress hormones and increases all the happy feel-good chemicals.
Do gay and straight people have the same type of sexual issues when it comes to communication and misconceptions?
When it comes to communication in particular, what the research has found so far is that same-sex couples do better than heterosexual couples.
Interesting. What is, obviously you've studied this from so many different ways, and as a scientist, what have we learned recently from science in regard to sex?
I think my favorite thing that we've learned about sex recently is this idea of arousal non-concordance. So we can measure the way people's genitals respond to sexual stimulation in a laboratory when they watch some erotic videos, and we can ask them how turned on they feel. And we look for an overlap, a match between what their genitals are doing and how turned on they say they feel. And it turns out for men, there's 50% overlap, which is not 100%, but 50% is
mm-hmm.
a lot,
yeah.
Right? And for women, there's just a 10% overlap between what their genitals
wow.
are doing and how aroused they feel. And the reason for that is not, as some people have tried to say, that women are just confused and don't know what they want, but because what genital blood flow tells us is that the stimulus is sexually relevant, and the arousal in the brain, the pleasure, that tells us whether it is liked and wanted. And it turns out for women, there's just a 10% overlap because female genitals are happy to code pretty much anything as sexually relevant, but that doesn't necessarily mean they want or like it. My favorite example is when they showed them images of bonobos, non-human primates, copulating, and their genitals still responded. Obviously, this does not mean that they are really interested in monkey sex. It means that their brains are coding it as sexually relevant, which is not necessarily liked or wanted.
That's fascinating. One of the things, and your book is a really helpful book, but then one of the things that brought a smile to me was at the end of the book, you ended with a reference to the movie Kung Fu Panda. Could you
yeah.
tell us about that?
Sure. So when I saw the movie Kung Fu Panda, I was with my my niece and nephew, and at the end, I was like, this is a metaphor for sex. I know that's not what I told them. But what happens is Kung Fu Panda, he becomes a Kung Fu master through hard work and the support of his teacher and the dragon scroll, which is the font of all wisdom. And when he gets it, he looks at it and he's very disappointed because it's a mirror. It just reflects his own face. And then he has the epiphany. There is no font of wisdom. There is no secret ingredient. There's just you.
Yeah.
And that's the answer to the best sex of your life. It comes from inside you.
That's Emily Nagoski, PhD, in conversation with Steve Wiseman. And her book is titled Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That'll Transform Your Sex Life, published by Simon & Schuster. Steve Wiseman returns to talk about the recent IRS hacking and things people should look out for. That's next, when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an event? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist, routine visits to your medical doctor, exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training, semi-annual eye exams, and a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist. Every time you walk out the door or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
My golden retriever, Sundance, is a lot more playful now. She has more pep and energy than I've seen in years.
Tons of energy. Petey is having fun again. He's got a shiny coat and a good, healthy weight.
Molly's been having 4 scoops a day. She pushes her little bowl all the way across the room, emptying every last single crumb. She has slimmed down and gotten this puppy look.
She's got life. She's got energy. She's got stuff to give.
We get asked all the time when we're at shows, how do you get your dog so healthy and shiny and glossy?
DinoVite.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Family will be on Dynavite for the rest of his life.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DinoVite.com.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, and we are rejoined by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Steve is an attorney and a prolific author. He's also the leading expert in America, or certainly one of them, on fraud and scams here in the cyber age. Steve is going to discuss the recent IRS hacking and things people should look out for. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, recently a lot of people were surprised when the IRS announced it was shutting down its Get Transcript system that enables taxpayers to get copies of the federal income tax returns from previous years from the IRS. People often use this service to get copies of early income tax returns they may have done in recent years, like when you apply for a mortgage or financial aid for college. Now, the IRS shut down the service because it just became aware that vulnerabilities in the system resulted in hackers attacking it from mid-February until now, posing as legitimate taxpayers looking to get copies of their own income tax returns. But these scammers were getting the income tax returns in the name of innocent victims and using this to steal the identities of these victims, file phony income tax returns, and claim bogus refunds. And according to the IRS, these hackers, which it has been traced back to Russia, tried to hack the system 200,000 times and were successful 104,000 of those attempts. Now, I say the fact that many people were surprised, but you may not have been, because we talked about this in early April. And the problem is, the problems with the system of authentication used by the IRS to limit access to this information to taxpayers seeking their own income tax returns. In order to access the returns, the system required the inquirer to provide his or her name, social security number, birth date, address, and other personal identity verification, such as what was your high school mascot or where you got a mortgage. The problem is, in a lot of instances, this information can be gathered by a diligent hacker from public databases, social media, where people put up this information themselves, and, frankly, data breaches, like a mortgage can be obtained just from the Registry of Deeds. Okay, here's the thing. If you are one of the 104,000 people affected by this data breach, you're going to get a letter, not an email from the IRS, and will be offered free credit monitoring services. The letters won't require you to provide any personal information in response. Any communication that you get that purports to be from the IRS, like an email or a text message that requests that you provide personal information, is not from the IRS, but from a scammer. So there's a lesson for us all to remember to try and protect the privacy of our social security numbers as best we can. Most identity theft starts with the identity thief obtaining and exploiting the victim's social security number. Don't provide it to companies with which you do business unless you absolutely have to. Medical care providers routinely ask you to provide this, but they have no need for this, and the healthcare industry has been among the worst in protecting the data from being hacked. The verification process of using personal identity verification information is frankly fundamentally flawed in today's world. Better systems need to be used, such as dual-factor authentication, where code is sent to your smartphone when you need to access an account. So when you can use dual-factor, use it.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. And Steve has written the book Identity Theft Alert, also The Truth About Avoiding Scams, both published by Prentice Hall. His website is scamaside.com. Check it out. You'll find lots of good information there. Live a safer life in this dangerous era of cyber scams. Steve Wiseman, thank you. Thank you, Beverly Santinella on the front line, our producer putting it all together, and Kevin Casey from Talkers, and Carol Marks, of course, the host and founder of the program. On behalf of everybody here at A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison, your anchor, inviting you to join us next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.